Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. I should say good morning, too, because this show is running live. I had to get Alejandro up early. He's on the other end waiting. He'll be joining us for the UFO updates. I had to accommodate our guest today, Eric von Daniken, and he's in Sweden, so I had to accommodate his time. That's why we're having this show at this time of the day, and it's nice to have this live stream on YouTube where I can do this, and I'm not stuck to any radio program schedule. That's the one great thing about not being on a radio program. A couple of things. We're going to be talking about his book. It's called The Gods Never Left Us. Great book. I really enjoyed reading it. And also, I wanted to tell people that I now have a UFO sighting reporting form. It's an anonymous form. And the reason I did that, that's on podcastufo.com. The reason I did that, myself, along with Alejandro, I know gets a lot of people that write us about their UFO reports. They don't necessarily want to report them on the page where the UFO sightings are posted now. I do have information where people can definitely report these things. I have links to MUFON and to NUFORK where people can report those to the center. I do encourage that. But if you just feel like posting anonymously, there's some great postings up already in just a few days. One from Botswana, a lot of orbs, triangle, things like that, a diamond-shaped one. So that's at podcastufo.com under UFO sightings, and all that information's right there. Thank you so much if you support the show. Anyone can support the show to listen to the full show for $2 or more a month. Greatly appreciate it. People can also see the full show on YouTube. But the good thing about the supporters, they can listen to it as a podcast in their media player, whatever media player they choose. Also, if you can't support the show, you can listen to the full show live always and on the Dark Matter Digital Network. And that's every Thursday at 10 p.m. to midnight. That's Eastern Standard Time, just before midnight in the desert comes up. Alejandro, how are you doing? Thank you and good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks for getting up early for me. I really appreciate it. And look at
my
that.
My pleasure.
Look at the background. It's nice and bright and sunny. I heard you said it's warm out there.
It is sunny as heck. Well, I was trying to make a joke because you kept saying my Skype was freezing. And I was saying that's strange because it's warm out here.
I see. Okay. Well,
warm here compared to there, but chilly for out here.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I'm going to push this up on my screen right here for the YouTube.
Whoa.
That is outside of my house. We had a...
Yeah.
Really afraid. We had a major ice storm here, and it was actually like 25 degrees yet raining. So that's a dangerous. I can't believe I still have internet and, well, I shouldn't say that. I might jinx it, but I still have internet and I still have electricity, which is very unusual. Usually it loves to go down in an ice storm like that. But anyway, I'm here. I'm excited about our guest today. And before we get it going in the news, I just wanted to tell you in this book that I just read, of Eric von Daniken's, he references, and he wrote this in either 2015 or 2016, I'm going to ask him, but he actually references the Pentagon, the secret Pentagon search in a roundabout way of things that he was looking into. I thought that was really interesting. Was that news readily available out there if people search for it? Do you know, Alejandro?
What do you mean he referred to...
He talks about, I can quote it right here, and I'm going to ask him to hang on just a second. And it is the U.S. Department of Transportation published a memo for pilots on February 9th, 2012, titled Section 8 Unidentified Flying Objects UFO Reports that tells pilots that they should report UFO sightings specifically to Bigelow Aerospace Advanced Space Studies and provide.
Oh, that's old.
That's old. So that's all part of this, the whole thing.
Well, so what happened is the FAA used to say it's kind of not complete. So the FAA used to say if you called them to send reports to NARCAP or NUFORK, the guy, you know, Peter Davenport, who you've had on your show. And then Bigelow, with the aid of John Alexander, because John Alexander helped him on this, they got the FAA to also include Bigelow. However, they were in the number two spot since New Fork was at the number one. We're live here, honey. Oh. And what happened was they were listed, but what's funny is, and I think that the FAA just chose someone randomly because New Fork, if you Googled it back then, they were the first ones online and to have all this information online. So I think that's why they were first. But so now Bigelow is listed. And even the first time I called the FAA for a UFO case, they said call New Fork, or I think an email I got from them said New Fork or Bigelow. So yeah, so that's they've been on there for a long time, but you make a good point that now that we know that Bigelow was working with, the DOD and this ATIP, you know, this program that they had, it sheds a different light on things. Now we know that Bigelow was also getting some funds and some resources to investigate those cases. It's just unfortunate. What's weird about that still, though, is why didn't FAA refer them to Bigelow first instead of New Fork first? I don't know.
That's a really good point. You know, maybe because that study was more or less interested in just military sightings, more or less?
You know what? I believe that to be the case. That's pretty much what Leslie Kane has said. And that is one of the questions that we'll be asking Elizondo.
Yes. And you'll be interviewing him pretty soon.
Yeah. So things have changed a little bit. We won't be personally interviewing him. Tom DeLonge and his people are going to be interviewing him, the TTSA group themselves. So. Mm-hmm. But Elizondo has said, I told him I've got a lot of questions here, and he said, I want to answer all of them. So I don't know if he's going to actually physically have time to do that. That would be a very long video, and he is a talker. Mm-hmm. He loves to talk. So, we're going to get a lot of questions answered, and that I'm sure will be one of them they'll be able to share.
Just one thing I want to share with you quickly. On your show a couple days ago, I talked about the fireball that I had a sighting in it. Sighting. Well, you know, I got an email this morning from someone that was from a guy in Nova Scotia. You know him, Jordan. We've been on his show. He does a podcast, nighttime podcast. And he was all excited because his grandfather saw basically the same exact thing I did.
Wow.
But it was like a year or two earlier, I believe. I'm not sure, but it's possible we saw the same thing. It's hard to say. But he brought our recording of that show to his grandfather in a nursing home. His grandfather listened to it and his eyes get all big. And he goes, that's just what I saw. That's pretty interesting, huh?
That is really interesting.
Yeah.
That sighting that you had is extraordinary. And like I said, I encourage you to get in that hot tub a little more often, because that's when it seems like you have the best sightings.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And like you said, that is not uncommon.
Yeah, it's not. Especially, it doesn't seem so much here in Arizona, surprisingly. At least I haven't heard it. Of course, I haven't been a MUFON field investigator for a while, but in Colorado, we got that a lot.
Yeah. Well, you have the wide open skies out there in Arizona and people outside all the time.
Yeah.
That's why you're one of the top, I think it's third most sightings in the country or close to it.
Yeah. By population, you know, sometimes it's at the top. So.
Right. Right. So what's going on for news this week?
Yeah. For news. It's funny. And I don't know what it is. It's the UK, I keep bringing up the UK, and the reason why is because, you know, the tabloids are writing UFO stories every day. And it seems as though they've been in this mode for a while to make sure and have a story every day. And maybe that's been, boosted by this recent news with the DOD, and they probably feel a bit justified because they're like, hey, we've been covering UFO stories, and now you can see that there's all this big stuff. But they, of course, cover it in a non-credible way. And so what's really frustrating is it's almost like they feel so much that they have to have a story that they pool some of the goofiest stuff. So there's some really goofy stuff out there. There's one with this alleged photo of on board an alien spaceship that's really goofy. But just be careful. What's really frustrating about this is sometimes they do great stories, though, because Nick Pope often does. Unfortunately, most of the time he's interviewed, it's through one of these tabloids. And usually they do a pretty decent job with his interviews. And of course, you know, I've had a couple on there as well. But yeah, just something to watch out for. Besides that, of course, we've talked about the fireballs on my show because there's been a lot of fireballs in the news. So, you know, there's one, been one in Canada. There was one, but although I think that might have been the one that was seen in your area as well, because often when these fireballs happen, the big ones, they can be seen in multiple states and through bigger areas. So lots of fireballs out there. Otherwise, you know, I think this is kind of a cool story. Marie Cisneros, she is the state director in Montana for the Mutual UFO Network. She wrote a story for us about Montana sightings, and she started it off with some pretty interesting sightings, but she ended it and well-known sightings for Montana. But she ended it with the story of this guy, one of their reports, who, while he was in Afghanistan serving in the army, had he and his buddies that were on a Humvee saw some giant craft that they said was floating around. They said it went over these hills, and it looked like it beamed down near this fire where these people were camped out. And then it moved away and they kind of lost sight of it. They called their commander and he said, "Hey, quit screwing around, you know, pay attention to your job." So they kind of ignored it. Although he said he indicated his commander had seen it also. So really interesting sighting that she put on there that I would encourage people to look at.
Isn't it amazing how there seems to be quite a few sightings during wartime or any, you know, conflict? It just seems to happen a lot.
I don't know. It's hard to say. Certainly, we have a lot of stories of the Foo Fighters, the balls of light following aircraft in World War II. And that seems to be a phenomenon. There's a gentleman who wrote a book on that. Of course, it's included in many books. But that seems to be a legitimate thing. And what's strange, of course, is that's early on in the late 40s in kind of the modern UFO I guess studies. It's almost like some people think that, you know, that's when they came, that's when we started getting observed, was during World War II, and it would be understandable why. However, since then, even though we get these stories occasionally, I don't know that anybody's done the work to correlate whether or not there are more sightings in war zones or not. Certainly military people see them. But related to that, and I don't know, we might have touched on this before, but this Nimitz case that Robert Powell has been looking into, that was part of the DOD release, that was a situation where they saw these lights, these military jets chase the lights, the lights disappear, and then... And that's a very common story going all the way back to Blue Book. You have tons, and other governments have these same stories where they see an object, they scramble jets, the jets get there and the object away at incredible speeds. So they certainly have a lot of those sort of stories. Do these objects know that they're dealing with the military or are advanced aircraft and they're kind of toying with us or something? I don't know. It's I think that's what's great about this latest story, is that I think that's what at least Lou Elizondo wants to know, is you know, this seems to be the case, that they seem to be messing with us or something, and that's what they want to find out. And at least he believes it demonstrates technology beyond our own, one which they feel we may be able to master ourselves, that technology. And I mean, the TTSA group, that the group that he now belongs to with Hal Puthoff, Steve Justice, this guy who worked with Lockheed Skunk Works, and Stephen, another guy who worked with the intelligence, Jim Semivan, another guy who worked in intelligence. But, you know, these are high level officials in intelligence. They all feel that, you know, it might be possible to back engineer just by observation this technology, and we could use it possibly today. So that's what's exciting about what they're doing. That's what they want to do.
I have heard that claim, and I'm just puzzled at how just by observation someone could possibly, you know, reverse engineer something. It seems like it would have to have a lot. You'd have to have a lot more than that to be able
well,
to.
Well, you know, it's interesting that Star Trek in particular has inspired a lot of technology. And
it's true. Yeah.
There's a guy here at ASU, a professor, and we've wanted to get him before at our conference to speak on this, but he is like, it's extremely expensive. He's as expensive to get as Dan Aykroyd, if not more, or Michio Kaku, because he's in really high demand. Krauss is his name. I think it's Richard Krauss. But so just by observing this on television and kind of like using the imagination that, hey, maybe this is possible, that makes these engineers and these people, scientists and just entrepreneurs and inventors to try to invent those things that they observe. So, that wasn't even based on. Yeah. So I guess it's possible. It inspires us to move in a certain direction.
Yeah. Getting back to the conflicts, I thought I heard, now it may be just a rumor, and I may have the person totally wrong here, but I thought Dr. Richard Haynes was doing some type of work on Vietnam. Did you ever hear anything about that, or am I getting that wrong? Or
That could be. I'm not sure. Vietnam sightings are interesting. We've got a couple articles that Antonio Junez wrote at openminds.tv. And during that period of time, he writes a story about a particular general who was collecting some of these stories. And they marked them down as enemy helicopters. Huh. And the reason why is the enemy in Vietnam did not have helicopters. So it definitely wasn't theirs, but it was an unknown object that they felt I think at first originally thought could be helicopters, but they knew weren't. And he knew they weren't, but he decided to use that name so it wouldn't, you know, arouse suspicion or people wouldn't get all excited and freak out. But so he could record these sightings, apparently. So, yeah. Wow. So it was a big thing in Vietnam to call them unknown or enemy helicopters.
How about that? Now,
yeah.
I know that I've mentioned this on my show a number of times, but I don't know if I've ever told you, Alejandro. So if the listener's a longtime listener, just bear with me. But I actually had an insurance agent that sold me a life insurance policy about 25 years or so ago, who told me that the UFO subject wasn't even brought up. But he said he was in Vietnam and he was talking about it. And then he all of a sudden tells me, well, I was actually in like a special secret. I forget what exactly he said. Secret task force, I think he said, something like that. And I said, oh, yeah, what type of secret task force? And he goes, we were actually investigating UFOs.
You're kidding.
That. No, this is back, you know, 25 years
and
ago.
And he didn't. Oh, okay.
I've tried to figure out. And then he told me there's a connection with nukes and UFOs, you know, the whole thing. And so, you know, I had kind of forgotten about it over the years. And then when I started doing the show, I remembered and I tried to remember his name. For the life of me, I can't remember his name and I haven't been able to reach him.
That's what's interesting, and I think that's what gets lost in a lot of when we're trying to create these grand conspiracy theories around UFOs and what the government knows is that, you know, a lot of these agencies, and that includes the branches of the service, work a bit in silos, and not even a bit, very much in silos, where they're doing their thing, they're not sharing their information with others, and then if that program gets canceled, all of that data and information just may just disappear, go away, and not even necessarily maliciously, but just because nobody's working that program, they figure, we don't need these files anymore, and they're gone. So it could be the Army had a program where they made some headway and figured out some of these things, but little did the DOD know, or little did Air Force or Navy know they had this program. And so there could be, now that we know about this one program, there could have been others that hopefully we'll discover over time, or some that may just be lost to obscurity, completely, that the files and information are gone. Maybe even the people who ran them have passed away, and we'll just never know.
Yeah, yeah. I would imagine, though, you would think that if there's some footage that it's stored somewhere, that's what, you know, it's got to be somewhere. I don't think they would destroy it.
Footage from Vietnam especially is very easy to destroy. And in fact, it can be difficult to hold on to for a long period of time. Film deteriorates and film, you know, unless it was transferred. And it could be someone just felt that, you know, hey, this is just going to be a black mark on the army. I think we should just destroy this. It could be at the whims of one person in charge who could be like, I'm just going to put all this in the incinerator. And that's it. And it's gone. So,
wow. Well, we only have a couple minutes here. So just real quickly, the International UFO Congress is coming up. And that's what your show is about. If anyone wants to listen to Open Minds last show with you and Karen. And also, that's coming up. I'm really excited about it. I want to tell the listener that if you are planning on coming to the Phoenix event, please seek me. Please search me down. Find me. It'd be fun to hang out with you. And also, we're doing the live show there at 4 o'clock. That's Phoenix time. So it's going to be 2 hours earlier on EST. So keep that in mind.
If we get a lot of requests for people to see you, since, you know, you'll be working with us, maybe we'll start to charge people. Be like $5 and we'll get you.
That's right. You got to make money at this event.
Yeah. So I'm kidding. Don't say that. You're going to make people so upset. They get all upset. Why are you charging us? And it's because these things literally cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. So we've got to, of course, lot of money is on the line.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, it's gorgeous.
The place you rent is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous.
And the food and all that. Oh, can't wait.
One huge point is that people need to register before Saturday. After Saturday, prices go up. So you get a major discount if you register before Saturday. So if you're thinking of coming, register in the next couple of days. This is very, very important. And you'll be able to see, among other speakers, I think the most exciting thing this particular audience would be wanting to see is Martin. You might see him behind a camera. You might see him at the we have a stand where we have the audio guys, you know, out in the crowd. You might see Martin there, or he'll be backstage with me. And so you'll see him around. And for $5, we can get you a handshake, maybe even a hug. Oh, yeah. Signature.
Yeah. No, I'm very approachable. So I've loved to talk to anyone. Alejandro, thank you so much. And I'll be talking to you next week.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right, take care.
You too.
All right, everyone. So now we are going to talk to Eric, and I'll be dialing him via phone, and that is coming right up. Pretty excited to talk to Eric. I had talked to him a few years ago, I think 3 or 4 years ago, for just a short time, and he's a really good spirit, a real nice guy. And here we are trying to connect. And should be ringing through. Eric, Eric, yes, how are you?
I am perfect. I'm ready for the interview.
All right. Welcome to the show. You're on live. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure for me. Tell me, what station are you?
Well, I'm my own show. It's a... It's called Podcast UFO. It's about 5.5 years old show I do, but it's live now. We're on YouTube, so we have a YouTube audience.
And, wonderful.
Yeah, we're live streaming right now on YouTube. And Eric, okay, I get it. Go ahead.
Yes. Yes. Where are you sitting? In which city?
I'm not in a city. I'm on top of a mountain in the state of Maine, if you've ever heard of Maine. And we had an ice storm. Yes, yeah. It's very cold this time of year. So
I'm sitting in Switzerland. I'm sitting in Switzerland in a place called Interlaken, which belongs to the Bernese Alps. It's wonderful weather, blue sky, and snow all over. Great.
Oh, wow. Sounds absolutely beautiful. Eric, I got to tell you, I read your book, The Gods Never Left Us, and it is... It was one of those books that I had a hard time putting down. I really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you for the compliment.
Yeah. And I'm not a huge, I used to be a real big book reader. I'm not so much anymore, but this was really a pleasure. And I have to tell you, the fictional short story you did at the start regarding CERN was fantastic. I wanted to keep reading it. It was really good.
That's a science fiction story.
Yes, you it know, was but, very, very good.
Yeah, it's not only fantasy. A little thing of it is true.
Yeah, I was wondering how you came up with that whole thing.
Well, you know, I dream sometimes. I'm a daydreamer. And of course, I was in Geneva. I was visiting CERN. And the night after my visit, all this comes to my head. So I made my fantasies out of it.
Wow, isn't that, that's amazing. That's amazing. So just a little brief story about that. It's about an elderly couple not too far away from the CERN. And the gentleman starts to see these green orbs, which is really fantastic. His son works at CERN, and but it's a great fictional story. So, Eric, I don't know if last time I spoke with you, if we talked a little bit, but I'd like to know what shaped you into writing books. I know you wrote a book just prior to Chariots of the Gods, but what led you down that path to start looking into these things?
You see, I was educated in Switzerland as a strict Catholic. And of course, when I was a boy, I was a deep, deep believer in God. By the way, I am still a believer in God. I am still one of these persons who pray every evening. But my belief has changed. Now, when I was a boy, I was in a high school, which was led by Jesuits, Catholic high school, for 6 years. We have to make translations of part of the Bible from Greek to Latin and from Latin to German. And in my boy's brain, God had to be something incredible, fantastic. But God had to have some minimum qualities. For example, God makes no mistake. God does not need a vehicle in which to move from point A to point B because God is all over. And so on. All this I had in my head. Now, while we made translations from one language to the other, I learned that the God of my Bible, he uses a vehicle in which to move around from point A to point B. For example, described by the prophet Ezekiel in the Bible. Or in the second book of Moses, before the Lord descends on the holy mountain, he gives order to Moses to construct a gate around the mountain so that the Israelites would not be destroyed. So Moses constructs a gate. The Israelites are in safe distance. And then the Lord descends on the mountain with smoke, fire, trembling, loud noise, etc. So I simply, as a young boy, I had my doubts. I said, but this is not God. My God would not need for protection to first create the gate. He does not need a vehicle to move around with smoke and fire. So I had simply doubts in my own Catholic education. And I wanted to find out if other communities in antiquity have similar stories. And that was the beginning of Chariots of the Gods.
Wow. And how did you do your research on that book? Now, I have to tell you, I think I read that book, but it would be going all the way back to high school. Not long. I saw the book everywhere, by the way, at my high school. It looked like everyone was reading it. And I'm talking like in the 70s. So people were still, you know, reading it for quite a while. But how did you do the research and as far as, you know, the ancient, the temples and things like that?
When from my family, I came from the hotel business. So after my high school where I graduated, I first went to the hotel school in Switzerland. After the hotel school, I had to work in different hotels in Switzerland. I was for a short time a waiter. I was for a short time a barkeeper. I was for a short time a cook. I was, of course, at the reception making contability. And when I read Chariots of the Gods, I was already the manager of a 5-star hotel in Switzerland. Now, this hotel was a seasonal hotel. That means it was only open in winter and in summer. The months between, I was free. And I was always traveling and reading. I read archaeological books. And I said, here is a mystery, but before you write about it, you have to learn what do other archaeologists say about this archaeological site? And then you have to go there. You have to touch it. You have to smell it. You have to be local. You have to see it personally. That's what I did. I spent a lot of money and time to go to all these archaeological places and to go to all the libraries and to study what archaeologists said. But of course, I still had an opposite opinion. And by the way, in Chariots of the Gods, I had 238 question marks. No one read the question marks. They all see what Eric Deniken said, but it was a lot of question marks in there. Anyhow, I was happy because with Chariots of the Gods, I made a lot of money so I could stop my hotel business. I stepped out of my hotel business, and since Chariots of the Gods, I was simply just researching, looking, traveling, discussing.
Wow. And how? Let's see, how many copies of Chariots of the Gods have sold that you're aware of?
Well, I think about 12 million copies. Only in the United States, there were about 6 million copies in the paperback version, and maybe about a few hundred thousand in the hardcover. But the book went all over the world. It's still published today in some eastern states. Before, there was an eastern bloc politically. There was a so-called Iron Frontier. Before that, Eric von Däniken did not exist in countries like Hungary, Romania, etc. Only when the wall, the so-called Iron Wall, broke, Eric von Däniken has come to these countries too. So still today, we have some contracts with some countries about Chariots of the Gods. Also, the book is 50 years now, old now.
It's really something. Someone sent me this question, and it's been 50 years since you wrote Chariots of the Gods, speaking of that. I'm looking back from your current position. Is there anything you regret including or anything you wish you had included?
Of course. You know, when you are young, and as I told you, I come from the hotel business. When you are young, you are not self-critical enough. You believe in yourself and you believe in every source. When somebody tells you of what's written in another book, you believe, you take it for true. Okay, so in Chariots of the Gods, I made some mistakes and errors. For example, in Aswan is a city on the Upper Nile in Egypt. There is a little island with the name Elephantine. And when I was there, someone told me the name Elephantine comes because the island seen from the air has the shape of an elephant. Later I learned this is all nonsense. The island has the name Elephantine because at some time in the past, elephants were on the islands. So it had nothing to do with the shape of the island. Or, for example, I was, as a young man, I was in India. I was in Delhi. And in Delhi, I visited a temple. And in the courtyard of the temple is one column made out of metal. And the column did not rust it. The column was there for hundreds and hundreds of years. The priest told me, I touched the column. And so I speculated in Chariots of the Gods, this might be an extraterrestrial column. You know, some material which we don't have on this planet. In the meantime, more than 50 years have passed, and this stupid column is now rusting. So I was wrong. So all these things happened. These things happened, of course.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And so in your book, in your recent book that we're talking about today, there's one place in there where you speak about, you know, what is the beginning of life? And I thought that was a very interesting chapter, you know, panspermia possibly, or the chemical evolution, the genetic code and DNA and all that. The odds are just so incredible. I mean, I don't know where you got your sources. I mean, your sources are definitely in the back of the book, but really amazing.
You see, I have good friends in Switzerland. And one of my friends is a professor, doctor in genetics. And he has a lot of time to talk with me. And we have had discussions. And he told me, Eric, you must control this in such and such a book, in that literature, you will find it. So I had helps from other. And in the meantime, I'm nearly sure we are not only the product of evolution. Of course, there is evolution, but not only. there was always, during thousands of years, some interferences from outside. And this is what mythology says. The gods created humans according their own image. You see, sometimes some critics attack me and say, Eric, this is all nonsense. We know we are the product of evolution. Of course we are the product of evolution. For example, we have on this planet, we have an apple tree. And the apple tree is a product of evolution. There might have been some 100,000 of years ago, some beginning of apple tree, whatever. But in the course of time, we have grafted. We did grafting. We changed the apple tree. So we went into the genetic of the apple tree even without knowing something of genetics, simply by grafting. So evolution of the apple tree, yes, but not only, because by grafting, we changed the apple.
Exactly. Yeah, I remember, I mean, they've been grafting for decades and decades, probably even hundreds of years. I don't even know.
Yes. Yes, yeah. It all started with the monk. His name was Mendel in Germany, but that's 200 years ago. That's okay.
200. Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I've always, you know, I've contemplated a lot, you know, how could the first spark of life, wherever it was in our whole entire universe, how could that have started? It's such a mystery. It's really, really interesting.
You see, finally, you still end with God. You could say, okay, this human race was created by evolution and by interfering by extraterrestrials. But then you have to ask the question, where did these extraterrestrials come from? Now you can say, well, they have been visited from another solar system. And where did the others come from? So you can play back this game for billions of years. It doesn't matter. Finally, you arrive to a starting place. And there, in every respect with religion, you will say, here is God. So you never lose God when you deal with the subject I have done.
Now, what about modern humans? You know, that's, I think, the science is out there that they consider the modern human to be, Homo sapien, to be like a few hundred thousand years old, something like that. I've always wondered if, you know, they're going to find out something else, you know, like perhaps, I mean, it just seems like such an evolution to, you know, to bring it up to modern human standards the way we are.
Yes, but, you know, okay, evolution is very controversial. The evolution today has become a form of religion or an ideology. There is a group of scientists who absolutely are convinced of evolution, and there is nothing but evolution. There is another group of scientists who really are qualified in their field. They say, no, it is not possible simply by evolution. There must have been an interfering by someone from outer space or from outside, whatever. And this is what mythology and the old tradition tells us. I am really a specialist in mythology. I have studied, I don't know, hundreds of books with mythologies of tribes all over this planet. Some tribes somewhere in the South Sea or in Africa or somewhere in Asia, tribes we have which had no contact together. No one ever heard from each other. But all begin their story of life with God, and God created humans according God's image. It was always someone from outer space who came and started the Homo sapiens, at least in mythology.
So what are your thoughts on, you know, some people think that, you know, humans were seeded here from elsewhere as an experiment, you know, different races. I mean, you hear of, you know, speculation and along that line. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm absolutely in favor of it. Have you ever heard about this so-called zoo hypothesis? Well, the zoo hypothesis, it's an American professor. I guess his name was Dearward. I'm not so sure. And he suggested, just imagine this whole planet Earth is something like a zoological garden. And on this zoological garden, you have different types of living forms. You have some of the watchers. You have the animals in there. And both the watchers and the animals and the visitors, they have to keep certain rules. For example, the visitors are not allowed to feed a crocodile with a living dog or to steal some wonderful birds. And the watchers have to be careful that the zoological garden functions, that there is food and water, etc. So there are certain rules. Now, these watchers, they create the zoological garden with all forms of life, and they observe us. And they realize throughout the thousands of years that one of the species, as Homo sapiens sapiens, develops society, develops culture, develops art, develops music, develops science. They observe that one day we leave our planet in a very teeny little machine, what we call today, you know, these space capsules. And now the watchers, the watchers ask themselves, should we permit the humans to leave their planet or not? And they say yes, because it's their own work. They have done it. They have worked on it. They should leave it, but only when they are ripe for it. And when should we be ripe to leave our solar system? Soon as we have learned that we are not alone on this universe. Soon as we have become modest, sober. You know, until today, we have two possibilities to look at our form of life. We have the religious way and you have the scientific way. In the religious way, we learn that God created us according to their image, but we are the crown of creation. In the scientific way, we learn it's all evolution, but we are the top of evolution. Now, in both cases, if you look at it religiously or scientifically, we look at ourselves as the greatest. Something like us does not exist in the universe, be it religion, crown of creation, be it science, top of evolution. In reality, we have a psychological problem. We don't want extraterrestrials. Soon as we accept them, we are not the greatest anymore. That's why we have to learn. We are not alone in this universe. Soon as we understand this, we can leave our solar system. Because there, outside, we will see other spaceships. And then we will realize, hey, what a shock. So we have to avoid this shock. We have to prepare mankind slowly. Come on, you are not alone. There are other forms of life out there.
Well, along those lines, Eric, what do you think about, I'm sure you have heard a lot about this and are probably following it. On December 16th, there was a New York Times article that basically told the story of the Pentagon secret UFO research. Have you been following that?
I hear about
that?
It, yes.
Yeah.
Not and, much, because in German newspaper, there was not much about it. But I hear about it, yes.
Ah, uh-huh. Now, on your book, I cited this prior to you coming on when I was doing the news with Alejandro Rojas, who was with me before we called you. And on page 53 of your book, you talk about the U.S. Department of Transportation, the memo that was published in 1912.
Yes.
And that has to do with Bigelow airspace. And that there is a connection there to the, I know you didn't realize that at the time, but there was a connection there to that Pentagon search in that statement in your book.
Well, fascinating to hear it, to learn from this.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's actually, it's still in the news, of course, news. There's so much news going on all the time that, you know, things fade really quick here. But there's more interest now in the UFO field than there has been prior to that article, for sure.
Well, UFOs throughout the last decades have always been ridiculed. And also in my new book, The Gods Never Left Us, I quote a CIA story which they have given up in 1953 to ridicule all the UFO things, to make it all ridicule. And we, you know, a normal personality, a scientist or a journalist, do not take UFOs for serious. He thinks this is all nonsense. So, and we want to be serious. That's why we don't touch UFOs in the past. Everybody wants to be reasonable, but UFO have been made unreasonable. That's why reasonable people don't talk and don't write about UFOs, But as you just mentioned, the situation slowly, slowly changes because too much of indications point to observations from outer space in our present time. And I know for sure we were observed and we are created in the past, some thousands of years ago. I have too much information from this. Finally, I'm the author of 40 books on the subject.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize it was 40. That's amazing. So in your book, you also mentioned, you know, who would have to come to grips as far as, you know, the different religions. I think you cited over like 120 different religions that would have a problem with us. Do you really think it seems to me the case with at least the Roman Catholic Church that the Pope is more accepting of extraterrestrials than perhaps other religion.
Of course, religious groups. But still, the Pope or a big high politician who are wonderful personalities, you know, integral and nice and intelligent personality, even a Pope could not go on public and say, well, I have to confess, yesterday night I had a discussion with two extraterrestrials. Then his own people would say, what's wrong with the Holy Pope? Is he gone insane or what? Even if you have a high position, you cannot say what you know until the society is prepared and willing to accept it. And at the moment, the society is not prepared and not really willing. That's why we have to work slowly to change the spirit of time.
I feel as though we're heading in that direction, but, you know, it's funny I say that, but also I listened to an interview from back in 1950 where someone was saying the exact same thing.
I'm happy to hear this.
Yeah, yeah. So it is a very slow process. And you're right, back in 1953, when they had that meeting, you know, about the ridiculing the idea, they just wanted to get the topic, you know, done with. They didn't want to hear about it anymore. They had no way to protect the United States skies, you know, so that's, you know, where that all came from. They had no answer with what was going on.
Yes, but in the meantime, we have too many indications. We have very good radar proofs for UFOs. We have too many sightings which cannot be denied because some pilots and some whatever high intelligence scientists speak about it. So the situation has really changed. We have clearly to differentiate among the UFO community. There is still a lot of rubbish, still a lot of nonsense, because the believers tell stories which they hear and which you cannot control. But aside of that, we have too many well documented UFO cases that we should become reasonable now and simply have the courage to discuss about it. But as I said, the spirit of time has to be ready for that.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, we have a lot of social issues to get through before we actually travel the stars too as well, other issues, I believe anyway. And I would like to talk next about a case that has always fascinated me long before I really got into the UFO topic, and that's Fatima, the 1917 Fatima case. And would you be able to tell, I know I just had the subject on my show recently, but for the listener that's not familiar at all with that, can you just in a nutshell tell us about that event or events, I should say?
It was in May 1917. Fatima is a little village in Portugal. And of course, Portugal is Catholic and the village was Catholic there. Three children, they suddenly said they had a vision. They saw the Holy Virgin Mary. It was an apparition. And the Holy Virgin Mary gave them a message. And this message should be given to the highest responsible personality on this planet. For the Catholic children, this was the Holy Pope in Rome. And he should publish this message in the year 1960. So one of the children, her name was Lucia, she became later a nun. She worked in a convent. And while she was a nun, she was interviewed three times. The journalist asked her, dear lady, what is in this message? What is the secret in there? And the nun said very respectful, I am not allowed to say anything, but the Holy Pope will make it public in the summer of 1960. So the date of 1960 was known to the journalist. It was on May 17. The Pope at that time invited, I don't know, 50 or 70 high priests and cardinals and whatever. The journalists were waiting outside the door of the room. And after 2 hours, the door opens and the journalist asked the priests and the cardinals, what's in the message? What's in the secret? And no one gave an answer. No one. They all keep quiet. Just the Pope at that time said, I am not in a position to publish the secret. It would create a panic. Now, I am educated as a Catholic. And for us Catholics, Mother Mary is the mother of Jesus. She's the highest female representative in heaven, in sky. She gives an order that this message should be published in 1960, but the Pope says, I cannot do it. It would create a panic. What kind of panic? The Holy Virgin Mary would know what she does. So after the Pope said it would create a panic, journalists came again with speculations. They said, well, maybe the secret has to do with the Third World War. Maybe there is a tremendous atomic war between the East and the world, that the West, you know, in 1960, it was still Cold War. Mm-hmm. So the journalist asked the Pope in 1980, 20 years later, when the Pope visited Germany, they asked him, has the secret something to do with the Third World War? And the Pope said, no, it has nothing to do with atomic bombs, nothing with rockets. It contains our fate. He said, it has to do with our fate. Now, but the Holy Virgin Mary, the highest female of the Roman Catholic Church, had given the order. Why can they not publish it? I am afraid that they learned that the message was not coming from the Holy Virgin Mary, but from a group of extraterrestrials. Now, of course, I only can speculate. I don't know the content of the message. I can speculate what could be in there. For example, they could say, well, we say greetings to you, Earthlings. Learn that you are not alone. There are visitors from outer space. We have been here thousands of years ago. We come spontaneously from time to time. Don't be afraid. We will help us, etc. But between 1917 and 1960 is a time span of 43 years. Between that time, the little village of Fatima has come to a gigantic pilgrim place for the Catholic Church. There is a wonderful cathedral. I was there 3 times. It's very, very impressive. Hundreds of thousands of people are kneeling there and they're praying to the Holy Virgin Mary. Now, 1960, the Pope reads the message, which dates back to 1970. He realizes it was 17. Not the Holy Virgin Mary. But in the meantime, Fatima is a pilgrim place. He can really not publish it, because otherwise he would discredit his own holy pilgrim place. So I understand the situation, but it's all crazy. In the meantime, the message should be published. He should have the courage to say, well, we have it to do with extraterrestrials.
That's interesting. Do you think that might have something to do with, you know, the Catholic stance on extraterrestrials has softened, you know, saying that they should be baptized or could be baptized, and there were a few other things. And along those same lines, there's also, I believe there's an observatory, Catholic observatory.
Has one, a very powerful Roman telescope. In Chile. Mm. Very powerful. Mm. They are very, very good. The Catholic high priests, you know, they are all Jesuits. They are very, very intelligent. Many of them have doctor or double doctor degrees. They are brilliant astronomers, and I am sure they know a little more than what they tell to the public. But you cannot tell everything to the public. An author like me, I can, because I have no. I'm not a politician. I'm not an official scientist. I do not represent any university. So a man like me, I can say these things, because the critics will still say, okay, that's his opinion. That's an opposition. It's another other point of view. But I feel I'm on the right track. Not on everything. I still may have mistakes or speculations which turn out to be wrong. But in that case, Fatima, it makes no sense that the Holy Pope in Rome does not publish that the secret, because the Holy Virgin Mary ordered him, you should publish it in 1960, but he didn't. And then till today, no Pope published the secret.
I wonder if it if that does exist, if it will ever be. You know, that's, who knows?
Yeah, one day, yes. You know, there is another speculation which I have in my head, but my English is not good enough to explain all this. We know that the magnetic north pole of our planet is always changing. Mm-hmm. The magnetic north pole changes is not at the same place where it has been some 200 years ago. Now, there are speculation that one day the magnetic pole might shift, so the Earth axis might turn. Now, I have to come back to Herodotus. Herodotus was a Greek historian some 2,500 years ago. Herodotus was in Egypt. He published two books about his visit in Egypt. He then talked to the old priests in Egypt, and he said, it happened in the past that of a sudden the sun stood still, and then the next day the sun went up in the west and went down in the east. Now, how can a very well-educated historian like Herodotus, 2,500 years ago, say such a nonsense? He would know exactly the sun will always go up in the east, cross the Nile, and go down in the west on the other side of the Nile. Now, in Central America, we have so-called old Mexican writings. And in one of these writings called Chimalpopl, the same situation is told. That of a sudden, the sun has come to a standstill, and the next morning it turned out in the west instead in the east. The same thing happened with Plato. Plato was the Greek philosopher. He writes this in his book Criterion. Now I ask myself concerning Fatima, has the message of these extraterrestrials maybe told to the children? They should tell to the Pope that sooner or later our Earth axis will change. And from one minute to the other, millions of people would be killed and destroyed because the water is overflowing what is today's land. And the Pope reads it. He first understands it's not the Holy Virgin Mary, it was the extraterrestrials who gave this message. And secondly, he reads a catastrophe will come throughout our mankind. He doesn't know a date. The extraterrestrials don't know a date exactly. They know it will happen. And now really he cannot go to public with it. It would create panic, as what he said. But in the old historians, Herodotus, Plato, Mexico, they say exactly this, that for a sudden the sun went up in the west instead of the east.
Wow. Yeah, and I know there has been some, at least, I don't know about actually turning on axis, but there's been, I know the pole has shifted, you know, in the past historically, you know, a long, long, long time ago, I believe. And I may be wrong on that. Someone will definitely correct me if I'm wrong. So getting back to Fatima, the incident itself back in 1917, how long was it after that all the thousands and thousands of people made a pilgrimage there to see, and they actually witnessed it.
Well, of course, you know, in 1970, there was in Fatima a so-called miracle of the sun. There were 80,000 people out in the field. At that time, there were no color photographies. There were only black and white photographies. I saw some of these photographies from newspapers from 1917. It was in October 17th, 1917, that 80,000 people saw of a sudden a gigantic light on the sky, and it was not the sun. And the light changed into different colors, and the 80,000 people were overfloated in different colors, red, blue, yellow, etc. Now, in the Catholic Church, this is mentioned as The Wonder of the Sun in Fatima of 1970. Mm. I think it was not a wonder of the sun. It was the extraterrestrials who simply showed up to 80,000 people, give them a sign, don't be afraid of us. We will return. Prepare, mankind. You are not alone in this universe.
Yeah, and where did these people come from? Did they come from all over the world there?
Yep, mostly from Europe, of course, in 1917. Some of them might have come from the United States. I don't know. In 1970, it was mostly Europe. You say 8,000 people were with the turrets out of the field. And as I said before, there are black and white pictures in the newspapers from August 18th and 19th, 1970, from that time. You see the 80,000 people. That day it was raining. You see many of them have umbrellas on. And all of a sudden, the umbrellas are away. And they all watch the sky. You see their faces enlightened in the black and white colors. It mm-hmm. looks fantastic. So they really saw something extraordinary.
Yeah, we're putting up some of those images on YouTube now, or the producer is. And yeah, that whole thing, now, I can't even imagine how they housed those people, how they fed those people. I mean, for back then, them just showing up. I mean, we have no communication like we do today.
Well, they were in the field, or they were with relatives, or they were sleeping outside, camping, whatever.
And there has been controversy about this all the way back for many years, as far as I know, that it may have had nothing to do with the religious aspect, as you say. So that is a part to look into.
That's exactly what I think. It has nothing to do with the religious aspect. It was extraterrestrials who showed up. The Pope had no chance. He could not go to public with it. Because if he would, mm-hmm. he would deny the visit of the Holy Virgin Mary.
Yes, that's right. And that would be a real barrier to go through right there alone. Because of right now, even right now, people are there as we speak, I'm sure, worshiping the area. And, so another question came in from Jordan, and the popular history show Ancient Aliens borrows heavily from the themes and concept of your work, Chariots of the Gods. And so he wanted to know your comments on that show.
On what show? On the movie Chariots of the Gods?
The Ancient Aliens. I know you're a friend of Giorgio's as well.
Yes. I mean, Giorgio Tsoukalos, he grew up in Switzerland. I knew him when he was a boy. He's a wonderful personality, and he has the possibility to speak, to go to public. I'm very happy that I have a translator like Giorgio in the United States. He's brilliant. Now, concerning Ancient Aliens, of course I am happy that they have done this series, because it brings all this in discussion again. I am thankful for them. All true, I do not accept everything which they say in there. It's a work of journalists, brilliant journalists, and sometimes they come up with, especially in the American version, that it has to do something with the Nazis, with the Second World War, and all these things. As a Swiss living just to the border of Germany, I do not underline that point of view. But generally, Ancient Alien is a brilliant show, and I'm grateful and thankful that it is on air.
It's amazing how many viewers that show has and how popular. I think they started out, they were only going to have like a very short season. And I think they were just going to do a series of, I think, something like 10, and that was going to be it. And boy, it caught on like a wildfire, and has been going strong ever since.
Yes, they had a very, very high audience. And, in the United States, when you have a high audience, that means more money because there's more and more advertising. So they continued and continued. In the meantime, they have produced 150 episodes. Just imagine. First, they wanted to start with 3, maybe 10. In the meantime, 150 episodes. I'm very happy about all this. Also, I do not accept everything which is in there.
Why don't you elaborate on some of the things that you don't think is credible? You just mentioned the Nazi connection. Is there other things as well you can comment on?
Yeah, you need, sometimes they bring story, for example, has Leonardo da Vinci been a time traveler? Or has he maybe had contact with extraterrestrials? I think this is not what I feel. But of course, everyone has the freedom to think in these directions. Or some of the humans in our time, some of the brilliant scientists, they ask even Wernher von Braun. You know, Wernher von Braun, he was the in the Second World War, he was the rocket pioneer in Germany with the Nazis.
Right.
Later, he came to the United States.
Project Paperclip,
In the United States, he was finally the one who made the shot to the moon with Saturn V possible. A brilliant rocket man. Mm-hmm. Now, in the series, they also ask if he maybe had contact with extraterrestrials, if some of his knowledge to construct Saturn V has to do with extraterrestrials. I personally think this is too far. I knew Wernher von Braun personally, not very well. I met him only twice. He was a brilliant scientist, but he had nothing to do with extraterrestrials.
I'm sure. Yeah, so there's a little stretch here and there, but some of the things I have watched that I thought, you know, I think there's maybe a little too much assuming in that show, but other than that, they bring up some really good points of possibilities.
That's true. And finally, we have to accept they ask a lot of questions. They ask always, could it be? What if? So they are asking questions. They are putting the question, which is okay with me.
Right, right. Now, another question that came in here. Your work has been criticized as being dismissive toward engineering capabilities of ancient civilizations specified by those who believe Egyptian tradesmen and women constructed the Great Pyramid. Can you discuss what makes you think that the builders could be assisted by extraterrestrial?
Yes, but, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding. In none of my books, I suggest that extraterrestrials created the pyramid or that extraterrestrials created Stone Age or the gigantic temples. It was always the humans who made these gigantic constructions. My question was, why have the humans done this? Working for, I don't know, 20, 50 years to make gigantic construction. Why? What is the purpose of it? Now, the scientific answer was always, well, they did it because of evolution. They wanted to worship some gods, for example, gods in nature, gods in the storm, gods who come out with smoke and fire. You can explain this with the storm and so on. So they explain it in natural way. I have nothing against the natural explanation. The question is just, in antiquity, some of our humans, they have met in person these extraterrestrials. They were discussions between the humans and the extraterrestrials. Some of the humans asked them, where do you come from? They always pointed to the sky, and they even gave some names, which solar system they came from. But the names mean nothing to us. Or in ancient India, we have so-called flying machines, many of them, different types of flying machines, they are called vimanas. Now, these vimanas never in the old Indian literature were constructed on our planet Earth. There is nothing, no industries on Earth, no evolution, technological evolution. But these vimanas slowly evolved in technology in our planet, that the humans created them. These vimanas always came directly from the mother spaceship, from the extraterrestrials. There is no innovation on our planet. In other cases, some of the humans have been up there. They described. Some of them have learned the language of them. In the old Indian literature, for example, Arjuna. Arjuna was up there for many years. He knew them. He spoke the language. Or in biblical terms, we have Enoch. Enoch, according to the Bible, was the seventh patriarch before the Great Flood. According to the Bible, Enoch was the first human who left our solar system in a fiery chariot. Now, in the Bible, you read only about three phrases about Enoch. But Enoch is the author of a book. The book was found 170 years ago in an old library in Ethiopia in a convent. The Book of Enoch was translated from Old Ethiopian into English and later into Germany. Now, Enoch speaks in the first person as an eyewitness. He describes what happened. He learned the language with them. He was up there. Enoch even gives the name of his teacher. One of the teachers was an astronomer. And he said to the young boy, Enoch, after he knew the language, human, look out of the window. Do you see this little light out there? You humans call it moon. But the moon has no light by itself. The moon receives his light from the sun. And then he explains to Enoch the moon phases. So why is the moon sometimes full, half, why it disappears, etc.? Now, these are astronomical instructions. And this is not nature, not the storm, or something which gives astronomical information. So that's the difference between the natural explanation for these old writings and the extraterrestrials. And you can really differentiate. We have too much indications which are not explainable in the old way.
Yes. A lot of good points there. I find all of this very interesting. In our country, we have a lot of Native American culture that claims, you know, the sky, that they were involved with the sky people, you know, through their history and all that, which is also quite fascinating. And like you said, I think you said earlier that, you know, no matter where it is on the planet, people seem to be talking about similar things. Very interesting.
Yeah, and they had no contact together. I mean, some thousands of years ago, they had no contact. And a case like Enoch, which we found in Ethiopia library, I said, had no contact with an Indian guy like Arjuna. But they both write the same thing. They were up there. They have seen Vimanas, flying objects, etc. They were in discussion. They were taught. You know, in the book of Enoch, the extraterrestrials even explain Enoch our solar system. They say, you see the gigantic light up there? It's like all these little lights you see out there. Each light is a sun, the different stars. And around these stars, there are planets surrounding. And the teacher says to Enoch, your planet surrounds the sun in 365-day point. What point? Because we have all four ears. We have a leak ear. But in the book of Enoch, it goes more precise. They don't speak about leak ears. They speak about leak hours. This is astronomical information in Stone Age time. Don't forget, before the Great Flood, we had no science at that time. They knew nothing about how the moon has its light from the sun and how the planets are surrounding our sun, etc. So this information you cannot put away.
Wow, really interesting. And I think in your book you reference the Dead Sea Scrolls a little bit at one in relation to this. Am I getting that correct?
Yes. I mean, Dead Sea Scrolls are absolutely fantastic. You know, in some of these Dead Sea Scrolls, we find confirmations. For example, one of these Dead Sea Scrolls is called the Abraham Scroll. There you learn that our forefather Abraham, one evening he was sitting outside his tent. Then he hears a noise about his head, and he sees a light coming down from the sky. He's afraid and stays up. And then he clearly says, two beings came out of an object, and he says, they were not humans. They did not breathe like humans. These two beings, they speak already the language of Abraham, which is easy to explain, by the way. These two beings say to Abraham, if he wishes, they would take him up and show him the planet from above. So Abraham has courage enough. He says, yes, I come with them. He describes, they flew up. Of course, he has no technical word. He believes that he's going up to heaven. He comes to a place where the doors opened automatically. He comes into strange gardens with strange flowers and vegetables and things. Then he comes to a big room, and in the center of the room there was a throne, and on the throne was the highest sitting. And when Enoch comes in there, the highest stands up from his throne, walks a few steps throughout Enoch, and shakes his hand, and called him, welcome here. Now, in theology, we believe that Enoch was simply taken into heaven. He was in heaven. He was near the Almighty God. He was the throne of the Almighty God. Now, again, I'm a deep believer in God, but my God would never have stood up from his throne walk the few steps throughout Hernock, shake his hand, and ask him his welcome. We misunderstood these texts. It's time we look at them from a modern angle, and that's what I try to do. So in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have many of these incredible things. There again, by the way, we learn that we are the product of a mutation. One of the scrolls is called the Lamech Scroll. Who is Lamech? According to the scroll, Lamech was the owner. He was a rich man, obviously, the owner of hundreds of shapes and goats and animals, etc. And he was away sometimes for some months to feed their animals where they find some green grass. After some months, he returns to his home tent, and he found that his wife first had the name Batenosh, just gave birth to a child. He was a wonderful boy. But Lamech said to his wife, "This can't be my boy, my child. I was away too many months, and all through this child looks completely different than the other children I have already." But his woman, Batenosh, swears and says, "Oh, dear Father Lamech, nobody touched me sexually." She even says, "Not another guardian, not another shepherd, not a soldier, nobody touched me. But here is the child." So Lamech doesn't know what he should do. He goes to his own father. That was the biblical Methuselah. He told Methuselah the story about the child, and Methuselah even doesn't know what to say. So he himself goes to his father, which in the meantime is the grandfather. And this is no one else than Enoch, the same Enoch who was taught in the mother spaceship. Enoch says to his son Methuselah, "Go to your son Lamech. Tell them that the guardians of the sky will create a terrible flood. All flesh on this planet will be dead. But we will have a new generation. Lamech should accept this child as his own one, should give him the name Noah, because Noah would be the survivor and the genitor of the new human race." So in that case, by the way, they say nobody touched Batenosh sexually. They made the sexual contact without touching her sexually. So in that case, and this is one of the Dead Sea Scrolls thousands of years ago, we learn that Noah was the product of an artificial mutation. And we all are the descendants of Noah. So we all have not only human genes in us, we have some extraterrestrial genes in us too.
Wow, that is interesting. Now, how do you think you must hear of these people thinking or speculating that there's hybrid, there's actually, you know, genetic things going on currently, today? What are your thoughts on that?
You see, I am sure that our genetics, they are so brilliant, they could easily prove this. Our genetics, they have the possibility with their technology to find out if in our genome is something which does not fit with to evolution. But even if some genetics know this, and he has found it, by the way, I told you, I am in touch with one or two of these brilliant men, and they say, yes, we could prove this. Even if they knew it, they would not go to public, because their own scientific group would say it's too early to confront the large public with these stories. We are not prepared for this. It's like UFOs. The society has to change before.
Yes. I do agree with that. Now, what about one of the things that always fascinated me in this story, basically, you were just speaking about also is the Nazca lines. I mean, they just... They make no sense except to be seen, you know, from the air.
You see, Nazca is a story on which I really unnerve me every time. Practically every year on some TV, television station, you see a so-called documentary. And then you see that it is very, very easy to create these figures of Nazca. You simply have to scratch away the surface of the desert, because the desert surface is brown. Soon as you scratch away with your shoes, a bright shining surface comes up. So you just have to scratch away the brown stones and the sand away, and then it's easy to create these figures like the fishes, the monkeys, the spiders, the hummingbird, and so on. And this is true. It is really easy to make it this way. But the problem is they on television documentary, they only show these figures. They do not show these gigantic lines. The gigantic line starting abruptly, ending abruptly, the biggest one is 3.8 kilometers long. Some of these lines are cut around mountains, which definitely are cut artificially. You don't see these pictures on television. They simply show you the figures. The average people say, oh, there are no mysteries. They lie with the pictures. I have in my one of my last books, I have shown 40 pictures about Nazca, which have never been published. When you see this, you're simply shocked. You say, why are they never showing us these pictures? It's the same question again. The public could be shocked.
Wow. What would you think that the significance of those lines could possibly be? Well, I mean, what have you speculated about that?
Yeah, these are signs for the flying machines.
That's what you think. I mean,
In Ethiopia, there is an old book called the Kebra Neges. There you learn that King Solomon had some flying machines. It was even said that King Solomon had some maps of different countries worldwide over the ocean, etc. Then I just mentioned before, Vimanas in old Indian. They were flying around the earth. So some of these flying machines were flying over Nazca. Some of the humans, the Indians in Nazca, they saw these flying beings. They could not understand them. Maybe from time to time, these flying beings made some languages, some landings, give the natives some whatever, some gifts. And the natives wished that these flying machines should come back to them. So the natives start to make gigantic signs in the ground of such overdimensional size that you can see them only from the earth. So it was the natives who made the lines and the figures, not the extraterrestrials. That was my speculation.
Wow. Okay. I want to read a quote. You know, this kind of goes back to UFOs, ETs, et cetera. Here's a quote from your book that I like quite a bit. And it goes, quote, "Who is playing with us? Why do we have to put up with it? Are they ETs? And are ETs really on Earth? Why could they do what they do with us, but clearly refrain from doing so?" Unquote. I love that phrase. That's really good.
They refrain because they don't want to shock us. We are part of them. They know our reaction perfectly. They know how we react. They know that this planet would fall into a shock. We mentioned before the different religions. They are not ready to accept such thing. Our society is not ready to accept extraterrestrials. Again, we have to change the spirit of time. And that's what I try to do with my books and with my speeches in public.
Now, I know also you talk about Stephen Hawking and Yuri Milner on their space travel project, spending all that money, and SETI as well, and the thoughts that what are they doing with all that when, you know, something is coming here? And I think that's a very valid point. I mean, there's so much evidence that something is visiting us. Why do people like Stephen Hawking and someone with the resources of Yuri Milner get involved in what's coming here?
Well, Stephen Hawking is one of the most brilliant astrophysicists on this planet, and he has a responsibility. And I think even if he knew definitely that something like UFOs exist, he would not go to public. He has a responsibility like the Pope. They would not go to public before the society is not prepared. Otherwise, they are, even if they are brilliant scientists, they are ridiculed. They are not taken for serious anymore. So it has to go step by step, very slowly. Fools like Eric von Däniken, like me, we can publish these things. Scientists must be very, very careful to publish these things.
And along those lines, I know Carl Sagan, you know, criticized you. I'm sure you get a lot of that. You've had a lot of that. How have you dealt with that? Do you just ignore it?
No. Of course, I suffered. In the beginning, when I was young, after Chariots of the Gods, I was very furious. In the meantime, I'm 83 years old. And I really love it. It doesn't matter. I love discussions. I love critics, and I love all these discussions with my critics, because in my field, I know more than they know. They know much more than I in their field, but in my field, I know not more. So it's always a question, how do we sit together? Are we listening one to each other, or are we interrupting? Are we honest? Are we telling the truth? And in every discussions with critics and scientists, I am happy that after 2 or 3 years, the other part says, well, we didn't know about that. We never heard or read about these texts and so on. By the way, right. Just that's some 45 years ago. I was in the United States. I don't know, was it ABC or whatever, in one of these TV discussions, together with Carl Sagan and with Alan Hynek. And I was really? Sitting among them. Yes. And Alan Hynek, I remember, he was rather a little in favor of UFOs. At least a little, he was a supporter. Well, Carl Sagan was against it. He said, no. Carl Sagan said, listen, if somebody would be here and would really observe our planet, they would definitely would have made diplomatic contact with us. And then Alan Hynek said to his friend, Carl Sagan, but dear Carl, we do not make diplomatic contacts with chickens.
That's true. And you bring you talk about ants in your book, you know, the 13,000 species in the world. And, you know, what are our connections? Do ants know who we are? Really, I like the way you put that.
Yes, of course. I mean, we have anthills here, and hundreds and thousands of anthills. And we know some of the ant families. They are dangerous. They destroy each other. They make war. They kill each other. Among ants are terrible societies. Now, we know this. We learned that. But we will never interfere. What do we care about ants? This is their problem. We could interfere. Maybe our scientists would find a possibility to learn the language of ants. But we don't do it. It's not our business. It's just ants. And maybe the extraterrestrials look at us at the same situation. We have a politics, some part, which goes crazy. Sometimes in our politics, we are afraid that there is a next war coming, etc. So we could say, but the extraterrestrials, they observe us. Why don't they stop us? Well, they look at us as we look at ants. The society has to be ready, and then they make a contact.
That's right. There was some article, I was looking for it now, I can't seem to find it right now, but there was an early article that Carl Sagan wrote. I think he possibly could have still been in school at the time. That kind of goes against what his stance was later on. I mean, he seems much more accepting of the fact that, you know, aliens could be traveling in space and, you know, exploring and stuff like that. But I know that, you know, I've heard rumors that with conversations between him and Hynek, that he would say that he just can't, you know, he believes more than he talks about, but he can't talk about it for his career.
That's exactly. Yes, that's exactly true. And I felt always like this. But Carl Sagan, I mean, he was a brilliant astrophysicist, a brilliant astronomer, and he didn't like it that a layman, a non-scientific man like Erik von Däniken, who was earlier a waiter and a cook, that Erik von Däniken comes up with these things. So he was away in front of me. If I would have been a scientist, the situation would have been probably different. But at that time, he had difficulty to accept that a non-scientific man comes up with these stories.
Right, right. And the last, or I think it's toward the end of your book, you talk about, again, I know Stephen Hawking has commented on this, but the future of artificial intelligence. And you know, one of the questions I have for you regarding that, do you think that artificial intelligence, if there has been discovered, I'm sure, if there are advanced civilizations out there, what type of effects do you think that would have on other civilizations as well as ourselves?
Well, maybe we are observed right now or some hundreds of years, since hundreds of years, with some artificial intelligence. Maybe there are space probes surrounding our solar system or our planet with artificial intelligence. They would react, they would calculate, they would learn, whatever. But even artificial science in artificial intelligence in the far future will never be human. An artificial intelligence they may calculate in a way so fast that we can never follow. They may see things so fast or learn languages so fast that humans could never follow, but they have no feelings. You know, right. every human is unique. Every computer is not unique. Every computer can copy the other computer, but the computer has no feeling. He has not something like love or jealousy or to being proud or to be feared or, you know, organs or sex, all this. Even if artificial intelligence will come, and it will come in the future, it is never human intelligence.
And what do you think about, I think it was, there's been a few people that have stated, Elon Musk and also Stephen Hawking have both speculated that artificial intelligence could actually be the end of the human race. What are your thoughts on that?
No. No, I think artificial, no, at least that's my feeling. I think never. Humans are unique, and humans will multiply, and humans will learn. Humans will go out in the universe. Humans will colonize other planets. Humans will make contact with other intelligent forms of life. Humans will have other feelings. And so artificial intelligence, no. Artificial intelligence, just that's the basis, mathematics, and not feelings. That's the difference.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, a lot of people that have claimed to have had encounters with grays say that they're very robotic-like, you know, no feelings and all that. You know, these are accounts that people have talked about for a number of years. It's not like, you know, one or two.
Yeah. But of course, then we have different extraterrestrials. Maybe we have a group of artificial intelligence who have no feeling, who are absolutely non-humans. But the ones who have feelings, they must be different. Listen, yeah. I have to run away here. I have to go to a place.
Sure. I understand, Erica. It's been a real pleasure. I've really enjoyed talking once again. And good luck with your book. And I know you're coming to the United States this summer, I believe. You're coming to, in July or June or something, right?
Yes, I have different public appearances, including at the Ancient Alien Conference and including at some universities. But I don't have the dates now in my head. But I'm always proud and happy to be in the United States, because the United States are still the greatest and most scientific nation in the world.
Ah, great. Great. And your website is posted in our show notes if anyone wants to visit. It's a wonderful website. I don't know who made that for you, but it's very nice. I really like that a lot.
I have never seen it.
I believe it.
Okay. All
right, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you. And we will have another discussion again somewhere in the future.
I hope so. You take care.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you. Ciao.
Bye now. All right. We are going to be back next week at the regular time. And that's next Wednesday at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we have a kind of an unusual show next week. The guest is Brad. He is the director, producer of Love and Saucers, a very, I think, some independent movie conference that he went to, called it the weirdest movie. So, but it is interesting too. It's about a guy that claims that he has had abductions from an early time. So that is next week, and that's again is at the regular time. And thank you so much for listening live. Remember, anyone can support the show. And all you have to do is go to podcastufo.com and you'll see the subscribe and support the show on the menu bar there. And I'd like to thank a few people. First of all, Alejandro Rojas for helping out with the news. And our guest, of course, Eric Von Daniken. Peggy for helping us with the Facebook page. You can like us on Facebook page. I think we have 23 or 24,000 people on that. Always, Peggy's posting interesting stories every day on that. And back to Alejandro, openminds.tv. All the news we talk about, a lot of times you can find right there on that website. And thanks so much, everyone. That's it for today. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.